Hi, this is Kurtwood Smith. You remember me from such TV comedies as That 70s Show and That 90s Show on Netflix. I'll never forget the words that my grandfather said just before he kicked the bucket. He said, "Watch how far I can kick this bucket." People ask me where I get my dad jokes from. I tell them to listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast. Listen to Daily Dad Jokes every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In this episode, we look at Don's influence on American Gigolo, Richard Gere's infamous full-frontal nude shot, Don's relationship with fashion designer Giorgio Armani, Don's invention of high concept, and teaming up with Warren Beatty to seek revenge against film critic Pauline Kael. Episode 2, More Don Fantasies Come True. Don had the sense an Alaskan-sized tidal wave was coming to Hollywood. A wave that would wash away the indie filmmakers of the 70s, clearing the way for the commercial films of the 80s. The movie that he felt could help shake things up was American Gigolo.
You know who I am. I know who you are. I know what you're thinking. You know what I'm thinking. You want to be here. You want to be with me.
His name is Julian Kay.
Was it what you expected?
His business is pleasure.
Of all the auteur directors from the Malibu scene, there were perhaps only two that Don felt he could work with, Brian De Palma and Paul Schrader. With De Palma, Don saw a stylistic kindred spirit of the lurid and the sensationalistic. It was De Palma who Don would first seek out to direct Flashdance. For a short time, De Palma was attached to direct before dropping out to make Scarface. With Schrader, it was more of a personality thing. Don and Paul always seemed to be the last ones standing at Julia Phillips' Malibu beach parties. High on cocaine, they would talk through the night about movies, religion, philosophy. They both shared a conservative religious upbringing. Both came to Los Angeles as a means to escape the rigid conformity of the church. Schrader documents this in his very personal film, Hardcore.
Middle-class person, Midwesterner, goes to church, believes in God, and it believes that at the end of his life he'll be redeemed. Doesn't make any sense to you. I don't know why I should have to justify myself to you. I don't care about the things you care about. I don't care what's happening in Los Angeles and New York. I don't care about the movies or TV. I don't care who's on Johnny Carson.
Well, what do you care about?
I care about my daughter.
Schrader was a Calvinist who took the view of Plato and Sophocles that delayed gratification was required for a path to happiness. Whereas Don chose the path of Siddhartha, the hedonistic first part of the tale, finding nirvana through excess, finding happiness through instant gratification. For Don, less was not more. More was more. It was in American Gigolo where their opposing beliefs came together. As Pierce recounts with Gloria Needham of KTBC.
Don saw Gigolo as the ultimate male fantasy. A handsome drifter who speaks seven languages, who gets paid to sleep with beautiful women, wear custom Armani suits, pump iron, snort cocaine, and drive a bitchin' Mercedes. I mean, who wouldn't want to be that guy?
As Pierce describes it, Gigolo was autobiographical.
It was in the sense that the movie was about a man like Don who comes to Los Angeles to sell himself and winds up selling his soul.
According to Pierce, in those early days, Don was a loner who lived through his movies and who so desperately wanted to star in them. His lifelong dream of directing was something he carried with him until his final days. If only Don could have directed. But Don wasn't the director. Where Don saw a movie about free will, Schrader saw existential despair. Where Don saw a glossy commercial film with Richard Gere strutting around in his underwear in a montage devoted entirely around him getting dressed, Schrader saw a somber French New Wave film. He even lifted the last scene of Brisson's Pickpocket for the ending.
Oh my God, Michelle. It's taken me so long to come to you.
In that final scene, Schrader is trying to make a religious statement, which is what makes the film a signature Schrader movie. But what makes the film an unmistakably Don Simpson movie was the glitz and the glamour, and how gay the whole movie was.
After Saturday Night Fever, Don had again taken on his mission statement that Peter Biskind referenced in his book Easy Rider, Raging Bulls. Don was repackaging gay culture for a heterosexual audience.
When I first interviewed Don, we went out on Santa Monica Boulevard looking for the prototype for the movie. I said to Don, look, there's no straight gigolos in West Hollywood. They're all gay. And Don said, that's actually a good thing. We can create our own gigolo. What he meant by that was that the best sort of movie is when you can create our own fantasy. And so that's why you see scene after scene devoted to showing Richard Gere like Cinderella going to the ball, spending hours getting dressed, trying on outfits.
But in this case, it wasn't a costume designer pulling clothes for Richard Gere. Don had recruited Giorgio Armani. At that time, Armani was relatively unknown in America. In a 2-hour running time, the film showcases every stitch of Armani's line. Brand creation on the movie screen. It had never been done before.
I mean, for Don, the clothes always made the man. It got to one point during shooting that Richard Gere had to ask, are you filming my character or the clothes? And Don's response was, how about we go to the other extreme and have you in no clothes at all?
American Gigolo marked the first time a major Hollywood actor went full frontal on screen. It's the kind of gratuitous nude we've seen women pose for a million times. How did Don and Schrader rationalize the scene with the studio? At the time, Paramount was coming out with their Oscar favorite Ordinary People and prepping the kid-friendly Indiana Jones. Why risk courting controversy from the religious right and Jerry Falwell?
It was Don's upbringing. As a child growing up with fundamentalist parents, Don knew better than anyone that poking the religious right could be good for business.
The critics, but for a select few, hated the film.
It's a strong picture, I agree with you. And you know, Roger, you and I are alone, I think, as critics across the country in liking this picture. Mm-hmm. Everybody else seems to be knocking it. I don't understand why.
But the gamble paid off. Audiences in even the most conservative parts of the country loved the film. Don had turned another relative unknown actor, in this case Richard Gere, into a movie star. After Gigolo, Don had no interest in working with another auteur filmmaker, invoking themes of Dostoevsky and Bresson. Don was a populist. He wanted to entertain everyone, red states and blue states, and he had a unique vision for what a Don Simpson movie could be. It was more than a vision. It was a manifesto, written late at night after perhaps one too many lines of cocaine. It was over 30 pages long. He would title it High Concept. When we return, we'll learn of how Don's wild night on cocaine would produce the memo that would forever change the movie business.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I was there. The night he wrote the memo, we were at Jimmy Green's house off Miller Drive behind the chateau. It was the house they used in Lee Marvin's Point Blank. Jimmy was a big real estate developer. He was known for his parties with the Late Late crowd coming over from the Rainbow Room. The washed up heavy metal rockers, the broken party girls, the real estate fat cats looking for young girls, you know, Don's people. Anyway, I hadn't seen Don in over 2 hours. Then somebody said he'd locked himself in the bathroom. I finally get him to open the door. He's on the floor. There he is. He's got his shirt off. He's very tan in his 501 jeans. This was when Don was very handsome, around the time he'd had the offer to pose for Playgirl. Anyway, he's on speakerphone, and he's dictating what I can only describe as a sermon to his assistant. It really felt like I was hearing something profound and important. I mean, I still remember the opening lines. We have no obligation to make history. We have no obligation to make art. Our only obligation is to make money. It was the Gettysburg Address of Hollywood memos. Don tells me the memo is called High Concept. I ask him what it means. He says high concept is a concept you can sum up in a single sentence, 30 seconds or less, pitched in the elevator, in the hot dog line, at the bank. Then he tells me to turn on the TV to MTV. Bands can reach millions of people in a 2-minute video. The movie business needs this kind of marketing. We need to understand the movie in a slogan, in a phrase, in a concept.
The high concept phrase spread like wildfire. Don was preaching a whole new way to view popular culture. Music, art, movies, politics, all of it could be consumed through one big idea.
There's something big waiting for me and you. Cock is it.
The biggest taste you've ever found.
Cock is it.
You deserve a break today. So come on in the McDonald's way today.
For those who've abandoned hope, we'll restore hope and we'll welcome them into a great national crusade to make America great again.
Some say high concept was just another term for dumbing things down. Others argued that no, what high concept meant was a rigorous vetting of the big idea that could reach the largest audience. In Hollywood, Everybody was talking about the memo and scrambling to figure out how to translate Don's prophecy into action. Years later, the founder of Grand Theft Auto and Rockstar Games, one of the most successful video game companies of all time, was so inspired by the maverick nature of Don Simpson and his high concept that he asked his employees to wear t-shirts with Don's face printed on them. Even after his death, Don was the wild maverick character that corporate CEOs aspired to be. But it wasn't just Don's memo that changed the business. It was Don's understanding of the economics of the business.
The way that Don broke it down to me was a simple art versus commerce formula. In the 1970s, the art drove the money. You took a chance on an artist, you put up $3 million for the picture and you hoped for the best. Release costs were minimal. The marketing ads were paid by the theatres. You opened the movie in just a few cities, the stakes were low if you kept the budgets low. But Don said no to all of that. Don said, let's make pictures with confidence. Let's put our money in a concept that we all believe in. Let's go all in with national media buys. Let's open wide and blow the other studios out of the water.
The concept was revolutionary at the time. But for Don's scheme to work, his team had to convince the head of the studio, Charlie Bluthorn. That would prove difficult. The press nicknamed Bluthorn Hurricane Charlie and the Mad Austrian of Wall Street. Charlie was a blustery, emotional man who cried at movies and spoke in a heavy accent. Go by the seat of your pants. Make pictures people want to see. Not this fancy schmancy stuff. I want to see tears, laughs. Barry Diller called him a romantic businessman. A one of a kind. In Charlie, Don saw a mentor. A guy whose restlessness matched his own. The problem was Charlie was too restless. Don could never pin him down. He was spending more and more time in the Dominican Republic where he was building his very own city. To make that happen, he was frequently on the phone with Richard Nixon trying to curry economic advantages for his Dominican sugar plantations.
I don't believe in a theory that we have got to sit back and let people hit us in the reply by saying, well, we will be this moderate about it. It's, Mr. President, you've got 1,000 acres of land and somebody comes and takes 900 acres away from you. You would respond by saying to him, I'm going to support you for governor next year because one of your aides says you don't want to lose your last 100 acres. To me, that doesn't have any logic or any sense at all.
With Bluthorn's obsession with Nixon and his dream of his empire city in the Dominican, he had become largely absent from the studio. Don would lose an ally who shared his passion for movies. He was already out of step with the Killer Dillers. Diller and Michael Eisner and Katzenberg were businessmen first, number crunchers. And their bottom line was under threat from a looming Writers Guild strike. It was so tense at the studio that Eisner would greenlight 6 films in one day to go into production. One of them was a film Don warned him not to make.
He was a beautiful white dog that was hurt and wounded. She nursed him back to health.
Good shot. There
and he became her best friend.
Yeah. Hey, what are you doing?
Come on!
Playful. Loyal. Protective. He was the perfect companion. Until she discovered someone trained him to attack and kill at will.
You got yourself an attack dog. A dog trained by professionals to attack people. Now that dog has got to be stopped before he kills somebody.
So let's say somebody trained him to be an attack dog. There's got to be a place where they retrain these dogs, and I'll find that place.
Come on, Julie, you got a 4-legged time bomb.
White Dog was based on a novel written by Roman Gary. The BBC called Roman Gary one of the great literary con men.
So he invited us for dinner. And when a few weeks later I left for Paris again, where I had work, I said to Roman Gary, please take care of my wife. She'll be alone in California. He said, sure, I'll do. And he did.
To Gene Seberg, barely 21 years old, Roman Gary was a figure of immense glamour. A soldier who had fought alongside de Gaulle. An author whose novel, The Roots of Heaven, had won the prestigious Prix Goncourt. Gary was a 1959 France's Consul General in Los Angeles.
I was in Paris to interview Gary. There was a rumour he'd challenged Clint Eastwood to a duel after having an affair with his wife Jean Seberg. Gary said it was true. This was just months before he committed suicide. He was more than a novelist. He was a screenwriter, he was an aviator, a war hero, a French diplomat. He dined with JFK, dated starlets. But what he was perhaps best known for was being an absolutely unconscionable liar. He lied so much, his biographer entitled his book A Tall Story. He made up stories the way you and I made up beds. Of course, it wasn't at all surprising that Don found Gary to be quite a colourful character. But Gary didn't feel the same way about Don. Gary wanted no part of a culture that glorified toxic masculinity. He thought men like Don were using masculinity as a facade to cover up weakness. It was an odd relationship, one con man calling out another.
We could find no statements that Don had a personal vendetta against Gary or any relationship at all. But it was clear he thought a movie about a racist attack dog would be a disaster. Gary supposedly wrote it as an allegorical fable based on Jean Seberg and her time with the Black Panthers. In the movie, a young Hollywood actress played by Christy McNichol accidentally runs over a German Shepherd. Little does she know, the dog has been trained as a puppy to attack black people.
That ain't no attack dog you got. That's a white dog.
Of course he's a white dog.
I don't mean his color. He's going to attack and kill black people.
That's crazy. I don't believe that.
What the hell you mean, huh? You see this scar, lady? You see this goddamn scar? Well, I got that when I was 14 years old. A white dog did it.
Eisner liked the thematic questions of the story. Is racism inherent? Is it curable? Is reform attainable? It's difficult to imagine a studio today releasing a commercial movie with such philosophical intent. For all of Eisner's talk, he touted its commercial appeal. It was Jaws with paws, he shouted. But instead of hiring a commercial director like Steven Spielberg, Paramount hired perhaps the most iconoclastic and most stubbornly independent director of all time.
Now, Gene Fowler said, whenever you interview any son of a bitch, remember, there's not two faces, there's not two sides, there's three. Now, the third side, you'll never get to know, really. Now, we can call the third side the mistress. Every human being has a mistress in the brain, Sammy, every. The mom and papa will never know what that son or daughter is thinking, ever, until they die. Never. No one will know. You can be married for 90 years and the mate will never know. Now, that's called the third face. It's a mistress. It's a secret.
Don knew he wouldn't be able to rein in Sam Fuller, not the man who gave us The Naked Kiss and Shock Corridor. Fuller's big idea was to shift the POV from the victims to the dogs. We'd see the dog slowly unravel into a psychotic killer of black people. Nobody at the studio accounted for the protests from the black community. The NAACP came out warning the studio the film would incite racial violence and told blacks to boycott. The Black Anti-Defamation Coalition warned it would spark race riots. Don was beside himself. How did he get stuck with a movie about a racist dog? And with another defiant auteur director whose mess he would have to clean up? When would the studio learn this was not the way to make money, let alone make movies? The bad publicity piled up. The LA Times called it a racist production. Don argued, how could a film production be racist? Fuller fought with the press, arguing that they needed to show the dark side of racism in order to see the arc to anti-racism. More groups threatened boycotts. And yet Eisner was convinced it would be a hit. Just get the poster right and they'd be fine. Don knew better. This was a rabid dog attacking people, not an ominous shark in the water. There was no suspense, no drama. Paramount, Don thought, had lost its way. When he first started out at the studio, they had conviction. Now they were cravenly hedging their bets, reducing exposure, selling off foreign rights, which meant lower risk but more cooks in the kitchen, which to Don was bad business. Either go all in or go home. If you want to hedge your bets, go to Wall Street. This was the movie business. It didn't help matters that Hollywood studios were still holding on to making art house films. And a big reason why was that the American public listened to film critics. Unlike today, they had tremendous clout over whether a movie would do well at the box office. And no critic had more clout than Pauline Kael.
It's a very even thing, particularly for a woman, I think, to be writing at home. It's a marvelous way to make a living. I think I wanted all my life to be able to make a living at home. The only thing I dislike is having to go to the city to see the movies. I love seeing the movies, but it's hell going through the process of getting to the city because I live several hours from New York City. But the process is simply thinking, really. I mean, writing is simply, you know, putting down what you think. And to be paid for thinking, and to know that you're doing something that may even have some value, that, you know, that some other people might enjoy that process and share it with you. I mean, that's a marvelous way to live. I mean, I can't think of any better way to live.
Kael was an unknown writer in 1967 when she wrote a 7,000-word review arguing that Bonnie and Clyde was a masterpiece. The movie had been considered a failure, but after Kael's review, it was reconsidered to be one of the great films of the era. Kael had the power to make a movie a hit or a failure at a time when film criticism really mattered. Kael's reviews turned her into a crusader for the arthouse film, and in Dawn, the King of the Blockbuster, she would meet her match. When we return, Dawn and Warren Beatty team up to take down Pauline.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Their rivalry began with Popeye. Bob Evans told Don he wanted Altman to direct it. Don hated Altman movies, and he hated the man even more. The feeling was mutual. When Don died, Altman wrote, I only wish he had suffered more. But Don was overruled by Evans, who had great respect for Altman, in large part because everybody's favourite art house critic, Pauline Kael, loved Altman. Evans got the studio to give Altman a massive budget. Altman hired Jules Pfeiffer, another art house intellectual that Don loathed, to write the script. He hired Robin Williams as the lead, even though he had done nothing but Mork and Mindy. He then chose Malta to shoot because it was as far away as he could get from the meddling Don and the Paramount execs. In the end, Altman made just what Don had feared, an Altman movie.
In looking back on Popeye, the movie has its qualities. There's a real sweetness to the performances.
And all at once I knew at once, I knew he needed me. Until the day I die, I won't know why, I knew he needed me. It could be fantasy, oh, or maybe it's because he needs me, 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 he needs me.
But for Don, the results were a disaster. Evans had taken their most commercial property and turned it into an art house trifle.
Don laid the blame squarely on Pauline Kael. She was a menace who needed to be terminated.
Don wasn't the conniving sort to plot Pauline Kael's demise. As fate would have it, he wouldn't have to. The story goes that Warren Beatty had been courting Pauline for months to produce movies with him. Pauline was used to having movie stars and directors courting her. Filmmakers like Robert Towne had put in months of phone calls and dinner dates to secure an admiring film review that could bring millions in box office. But Beatty had a bigger endgame. He had sensed that Pauline was unhappy at The New Yorker. Behind the scenes, he had negotiated with Barry Diller to give Pauline an executive position. He would promise her an office, and her first project would be Love and Money, to be directed by James Toback, whose movie Fingers Pauline had given a rave review. It was easy for Beatty to sell Barry Diller on Pauline. He had long been a fan and understood her importance in the business. For Beatty, it meant having an ally at the studio to help him produce his movies. What was shocking was that Pauline, the most famous film critic in the world, said yes. Just days after Beatty's proposal, she would quit The New Yorker. Pauline's friends had warned her not to go to Hollywood. She was a film critic living in the Berkshires who would take the train into New York City each week to see movies and write reviews. She had a charmed life. Why give it all up to move into those shark-infested waters of Hollywood? Don was asking the same question. You can imagine Don's tremendous shock to learn of Paramount's new hire. The critic who had been the bane of Don's existence was now sitting in his office?
Don couldn't believe his good fortune. Here was Pauline Kael in his office talking about pretentious art house movie projects that she'd like to make at Paramount. It wasn't a question of if Don would destroy the career of Pauline Kael. It was a matter of when.
A few weeks into the job, Kael knew she was in trouble. James Toback had not been receptive to her script notes. In his mind, a script was not finite, but amorphous, something to be shaped in production. When Toback froze her out, she sought protection in Barry Diller. But it was soon clear to her that the business was about getting movies made quickly, and that spending months on scripts was not economically viable. To make matters worse, she had to answer to Don, the man who, in her mind, represented the lowest common denominator of filmmaking. A Neanderthal who thought a movie's genius was in its marketing potential as a one-sentence tagline on a poster. Don, for his part, treated Kael with respect. He, of course, rejected every single one of her movie ideas, but always with a polite note as to why the studio couldn't give her the green light. This went on for months. Pauline would go to Don's office, and Don would politely say no. As Don later told Paul Schrader, Pauline Kael was his surprise birthday cake. All he had to do was use the knife. For the next 5 months, Kael sat alone in her office, waiting for various producers to drop by so she could offer up her opinions. Opinions that at one time had shaped the hearts and minds of film audiences all over the world were now deposited into the trash bins of Paramount. There was simply no path forward for Kael. Her only way out was to quit the studio and crawl back to The New Yorker. She wasn't the same critic when she returned. She had seen the inside of the Hollywood machine firsthand, and it was more loathsome than anything she had ever heard. She had lost her love for the movies. The high-concept era was coming, and the beloved artists that she had championed, Altman, Ashby, Bogdanovich, Coppola, even Scorsese, were sidelined. There was no purpose, no importance for a great champion of films like Pauline Kael. Kael's downfall was a big victory for Don. The great directors of the decade were now pushed aside. Don's path was now clear. There was a light at the end of the tunnel, if he could only get out of his own self-destructive way. The Don Season 2 is executive produced by Will McCormick and David Harris Klein. Klein also wrote and created the series. Mike Jurasitz is the editor, sound designer, and producer of the series. The podcast is produced and narrated by Malaya Rivera-Drew. That's me. Louis Weymouth voices the character of Pierce and also produces the series. For more episodes of The Don Season 2, listen to the series on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, this is Kurt Woodsmith. You remember me from such TV comedies as That 70s Show and That 90s Show on Netflix. I'll never forget the words that my grandfather said just before he kicked the bucket. He said, "Watch how far I can kick this bucket." People ask me where I get my dad jokes from. I tell them to listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast. Listen to Daily Dad Jokes every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.